This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. Amira Aisha is one of the founding members and Secretary General of Parti Muda. Not only that, other members and supporters of the party regard the 27-year-old as the Iron Lady of Muda. Amira will be making her debut as a political candidate in the upcoming Johor State elections, competing for the Puteri Wangsa seat. She joins me on the show today to share why she decided to join politics, seat negotiations with Pakatan Harapan, as well as how she and Muda are planning to improve the lives of everyday Johorians. Welcome to the show, Amira.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dashen, for having me here.
All right, Amira, before we get into the, you know, the more serious stuff, you know, the policies and the seat negotiations and whatnot, I wanted to ask you about yourself. You, like most Muda members, except perhaps Syed Saleh himself, are completely new to frontline politics. Why did you decide to join politics and start Muda?
I don't come from a family of politicians. Like, I don't have any aunties or uncles, or, you know, I don't know any of my relatives who are politicians. My mother's a teacher. My late dad was also a teacher before he passed away. And, you know, my family are mostly made up of, you know, regular Malaysian, like you and I. But when I was growing up, when my father passed away, my mother was a single mother, and we stayed with my grandmother at Kampung Melayu Majidi, which is a squatter area in the heartland of Johor Bahru. And while I was growing up, I realized that, the socio-economic justice wasn't there for the people in the B40 community. Although there are parties who say that they are fighting for the Malays, they are fighting for to ensure that the Malays are moving forward. By the end of the day, when I looked at my community, I see that there's not much difference from when we were, 20, 30, 50 years ago to where we are now. For those who are in M40 and T20, it's quite easy for them to, climb the economic ladder. However, in the lower end of B40 communities, it's just very tough for them to get out of the social economic justice problem. And I think when I was looking at all these things, I look at my childhood friends who got into drugs, my childhood friends who got pregnant while they were still in school, and also a lot of them were dropped out from schools at a very young age, I realized that at the end of the day, in order for you to ensure that people in the lower B40 communities can get out of the cycle of poverty, is in order for you to ensure that, number one, that they have good, obviously, economic support, but number two is good quality education. I realized that with good quality education, it's sort of like the key for you to break out of the cycle of poverty. So when I was growing up, I never had an intention of being a politician.
Right.
But I know that I want to do something about education. I was very passionate about education. And so after I finished my chambering, I was a law grad and I did my chambering. After I finished my chambering, I decided to join a policy think tank under the Ministry of Education.
Right.
And, we were doing all these things about education. And while I was in PADU, that was when I realized that in order for you to push for a very good policy forward, it's not enough for you to have good people in public policy. It's not enough for you to have things nicely written on paper. Because at the end of the day, what's very, very important, especially in Malaysia, is the political will to push it through. I realized that without this political will, it's quite tough for you to create differences or create changes. And this was made more apparent after Langkah Sheraton.
Right.
Because I realized that in order for you to get a very good quality education, in order for you to change the system, you have to ensure that there are good people in power in the political play, because it's important for them corruption and all these things will affect the overall ecosystem of the country. And so that was when, after Langkah Sheraton, I realized that you need the involvement of good and smart people in politics in order for you to create actual changes. And so I texted Sadiq and I asked him to form a new party. I said, form a new party with young and smart people and I'll join your fight. Before that, he has asked me to join Bersatu, which I rejected because I don't think it resonates well with me. But now I belief in MUDA. I believe that it's time for us to create changes in politics. It's time for us to create actual things like Political Funding Act, introducing SOPs in terms of political funding, because at the heart of corruption is actually political funding. And if you manage to regulate political funding, then slowly you manage to unveil all the other things that are problematic in the system and ensure changes in the long run.
Now, you mentioned Bersatu and how your political ideologies or leanings didn't align with that of Bersatu's. What is the difference between your politics and Bersatu's?
Well, number one, the thing about the older political parties, obviously, when in PRU14, I was an avid supporter of Pakatan Harapan. I believe in what they can do. I believe in what they promised. And I voted for Pakatan Harapan in the GE14. Although votes is a secret, but I'm not making it a secret lah.
Right.
But what I think is very, it doesn't resonate well with me. Although I support them, I don't feel like joining any political party or any traditional political party simply because I'm not favorable to the existing culture of political parties in which the young and the women are always separated from the actual leadership of the party.
Right.
So when you look at the higher leadership of the party, it's always made up of an old Malay man or old, man. Meanwhile, the young are separated into youth wing and the women are separated into women's wing. And the highest they can go at most is the chief of the youth wing or the chief of the women's wing. And then you only have like one or two or a very few of them who can break out of those wings and get into the top leadership of the party. So it's very tough. Meanwhile, you look at the top leadership of any party, when you look at the lineup, you realize that most of the people there don't even deserve to be there. There are better people in the youth wing. There are better people in the women's wing. But it's tough for them to get there because I think the structure of the party is such that it always recognizes older men rather than, the young who are visionaries and the women who are just as capable, if not more so, than the men in the party. And so when we formed MUDA, we wanted to have equality for everyone, right? Equal chance for everyone, regardless of your race, regardless of your background, whether you are new in politics, whether you are old in politics, regardless of, your age. In our own Central Executive Committee, we have Rifaya, who is as young as 19 years old, and we have Ismail, who is already, in his late 50s.
Right.
And that shows the diversity of age in our Central Executive Committee. And regardless of gender as well, I mean, I myself am a 27 years old woman, is given the trust to lead the helm of and being the Secretary General of MUDA. I think that's really quite big and something new for a party in Malaysia. And so I believe that these equal chances have to be created and MUDA has to show to other parties that it is possible. Because before this, everyone thought that that's something that is of the norm, that you have to have youth wing, you have to have women's wing, and you have to have older men as the president of the party. But we need to show them that it is possible for you to change this narrative, and that's why MUDA is created.
Awesome. Now, what was your childhood like? You brought up a little bit of it just now, right? Growing up with a single mom and, looking around your communities and seeing the problems that they face and all of that. Did your mom or, perhaps uncles and all, while they were not in frontline politics involved in politics at all, but were they engaged with the going-ons of the country? Did y'all used to talk about politics a lot, things like social justice and economic justice and all of that?
My mom is a teacher for more than 30 years. And so being a teacher, and, she once became like the Penolong Kanan Haliwal Murid, Pengetua and all that. So with these positions, she's always concerned about the well-being of her students. When we were staying at Kampung Melayu Majidi, my mother was a teacher at Sekolah Kebangsaan Majidi Baru, which is now changed into Sekolah Menengah Kebangsaan Tun Said Nasir Ismail. And when she was teaching, she always came back to us and tell us stories about how socioeconomic justice is impacting her students. So we do talk a lot about socioeconomic justice. So there were problems in her school, for example, problems that are still, you know, pertaining until today, like problems of stateless children in the school, where you have children who don't have documents. So, you know, on the graciousness of the teachers, they allow the students to sit for education, to sit in the classrooms. But at the end of the day, when it comes to taking actual examinations, they are not eligible to take PMR, they're not eligible to take SPM. And these are really, really important issues, because at the end of the day, these children are not, you know, they don't have you know, citizenship in other countries, so you can't award them passports. They are perhaps the third and fourth generation of Malaysians here. And so it's high time for you to award them with documentations, right? For them to have equal access to education. We talk about how poverty is really impacting the welfare of the students. And when it impacts the welfare of the students, at the end of the day, it impacted the education. And it's very tough for them to again break out of the cycle of poverty. So we're always talking about these things, about the socioeconomic justice part of it. But in terms of the political side, we always feel that, well, it's tough for you to change the political landscape, you know. We always have this idea that politics is dirty, and whoever joined politics will get their hands dirty in the process. And so, and that is why I think one of the things that is very controversial after the announcement of my candidacy was, I mentioned that I promised to my mother that I won't join politics, right, but then I broke my promise. Because at that point of time, actually, a lot of my family members were telling me to join politics because they believe that I can do something about it. But at that point of time, I thought that I can, you know, serve better in public policy, and I don't believe that politics will ever change. Lah. Mm-hmm. But after Lanka Sheraton, before I joined politics, I sit down with my family, my mother, my brothers, my sister, and some of my very close uncles and aunties. And I did consult with them. And they were very excited for me to join, actually, because they said it's time for us to have really good people in politics. It's time for us to have, you know, someone from my background. I'm sure there are a lot of people within politics that were in my background, but, you know, someone who didn't come from the elites class to be out there and speak about the problems within my class. And I think after that, my family has been my biggest support. And, you know, we often bounce ideas in terms of politics, and especially with my mother, in terms of how to improve education as a whole.
On the show with me today is Amira Aisha, Sekjen of Parti Muda. After the break, I ask her about problems faced by Johorians and how she and Muda hopes to solve them. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Amira Aisha, Secretary General of Parti Muda. And Amira will be making her debut as a political candidate in the upcoming Johor State elections in the Puteri Wangsa seat. So, Amira, let's zoom in on the Johor State elections, Amira. Let's start by talking a little bit about seat negotiations. First of all, why negotiate for seats at all? From my understanding, even based on what you just told me, Muda was born post Lanka Sheraton because many young people, including yourself, were frustrated with the overall political landscape, regardless whether it's Barisan Nasional, Pakatan Harapan. Young people were frustrated with just the landscape as a whole. But now you're getting into an electoral loose electoral alliance of sorts with Pakatan Harapan. What is the justification for this?
So, well, the beauty of not joining a coalition is that you can freely be involved in the democratic process without much thinking about, you know, which seat is available for me and which seat is available for my partner. And so that's what Muda was striving for, you know, at the start of it. But when we're looking at the, you know, the structure of politics, as of now, when you look at the fall of Melaka and then now Johor, and then you have the rumours of the fall of Kedah, and you have the rumours of general election coming, to us, it's very important for us to ensure that there's political stability first. It's very important for us to ensure that Barisan Nasional doesn't win in the state of Johor, which will give them the boost of confidence to then, you know, do election in Kedah and then the general election in the near future. So when we're talking about the seats negotiation, it's not much about saying that which seat is yours and which seat is mine, because at the end of the day, we believe that the seats don't belong to any political party, right? It's a democratic country. The people get to choose. And whoever is contesting there, the seat belongs to the people. For example, when we're talking about the seat of Puchi Wangsa, it doesn't belong to Muda right now, right? It belongs to the people of Puchi Wangsa. And it's up to the people of Puchi Wangsa to choose who they want to be the elected representative there. And I think, but when it comes to seat negotiation with Pakatan Harapan, it's because number one, in comparison with other parties, Pakatan Harapan, you know, the principles of MUDA align most with the principles of Pakatan Harapan, right, where we believe that there's a need for us to fight against money politics. There's a need for us to fight against race-based politics. And so Pakatan Harapan resonates most with MUDA in comparison with other parties, right? And so the reason for negotiation is not about like wealth distribution or like, you know, trying to distribute seats between us, but it's to minimize seats clashes. Because in order for you to win Johor, to be realistic, when you look at the voter turnout in Melaka and then you look at voter turnout in Sarawak, the best way for you to win Johor is to ensure that there's no seat clashes between the opposition parties, because you need to win the majority non-Malay votes and then the fence-sitters within the Malay votes, the Malay voters, right? And in order for you to do that, even if we can't ensure 100% zero seat clashes, but we have to minimize as much as possible. And so that's the purpose and the goal of MUDA when we enter into seat negotiation with our partners in Pakatan Harapan. And Alhamdulillah, with DAP and Amanah, we managed to resolve that. And MUDA, you know, we understand that we're a new party, right? Although a lot of people are saying that, oh, MUDA is very arrogant, trying to get a lot of seats. But we know, we reflect ourselves. We know that we're a very new party. We've only been registered for 2 months. We don't have machineries like older generational parties, right? And so we managed to secure 6 seats with DAP and Amanah. And that's, you know, that's 6 out of 36 seats that belong to DAP Amanah. And so it's not about arrogance. It's about securing seats that we think we can win and contribute to the electoral pact as a whole. And so that was the purpose of the seat negotiation in the first place, to ensure that at the end of the day, we managed to secure the Johor state election and ensuring the political stability for other states and the nation as a whole.
Now, you mentioned seat negotiations with DAP and Amanah, and you know, it really, as the reports indicated and all, it concluded very swiftly and amicably. Very fast. You have y'all secured the 6 seats, and that was settled. But negotiations fell through with PKR even until now. Things appear slightly unclear. But not only did it fall through, there was a period of about 2 weeks, perhaps over the past couple of days, things have simmered down a little bit, but there was a period of 2 weeks where members and supporters, frankly, of both parties were publicly hurling proverbial bricks at each other on Twitter. There was a lot of toxic dialogue. There was very little focus on real issues concerning the people. Instead, it was about, you know, name calling and all of these things between PKR and MUDA, whether it's the grassroots members, the supporters and whatnot. Why did it get to that point?
I mean, I can't get into the nitty-gritty of negotiation detail, because at the end of the day, I believe that negotiation should be private between the parties, you know, negotiating within it. But at the end of the day, what I can say, especially to the supporters of MUDA and PKR, is that we did try our very best to negotiate between both parties. I can't speak for PKR, obviously, but I can speak for MUDA. We tried our very best to ensure that we get to secure seats that are, you know, have higher winnable chances for both parties, right? And we did our very best to ensure that we don't, cross the boundaries of friendship, where we don't even start negotiating on incumbent seats of PKR. And that is the respect that we give to all our partners, right? Meanwhile, actually, if we want to be, you know, if we are arrogant and if we are really, seats crazy and all that, we can always go into the already incumbent seats, where we are very, very strong, you know, when we're looking at the polling results. But at the end of the day, that's not what we want. We don't want to win alone. We want to win together with DAP, Amanah and PKR. And so when we entered the negotiation seat, we understand that we can't negotiate on incumbent seat, and we follow through with that. You know, obviously, politics is very fluid. And then at the end of the day, we managed to secure seats with DAP and Amanah, but negotiation with PKR is not as smooth as we would want it to be. But what I would like to implore for the supporters of Muda and PKR is that the people of Johor, the regular people of Johor, and I'm speaking this because I know, because I was the regular people of Johor, you know, like my family is still the regular people of Johor. We don't care about seats negotiation. We don't care which party gets how many seats. What we care about is what are you fighting for us? What we care about is why are your party better than the opposition parties? And for the supporters of Muda and PKR, whatever happens after this, right? Like I mentioned before, seats negotiation at the end of the day is the objective is to minimize seat clashes. But if that can't be done, put that aside and focus on what we want to offer for the people of Johor. What is our goal in ensuring that there's quality access of education for the children in Johor? What are we going to do to ensure that the economic justice of people in Johor are being well taken care of? What do we want to offer for the people of Johor? And that matters more to the regular Johorian voters, and that will make them excited to go out to vote. Looking at this fighting, right, this infighting within the electoral pact itself is very disheartening to the voters. They don't want to read about that. They don't want to know that your parties are fighting. Even if you are, you don't have to, you know, openly shout out loud about it. You resolve it amicably, and then you move on with the more important stuff, which is what you want to serve and how are you going to serve the people of Johor better. And so beyond this, whatever's happening after this, I really, really hope that, I mean, I can't speak to the PKR supporters, obviously, but for the Muda supporters, we are not established to just show that we are the best party, right? We are not established in order for us to show that we are better than PKR or even better than UMNO for that fact. We are established because we believe in the politics of service, we believe in the politics of policy, and we believe in the politics of values to bring new politics into the system. And if you are a Muda supporter and you believe in all these things, you know, simmer down with the fighting and the hurling of mean words and focus on what we want to offer to the people of Johor.
Now, I want to pick up on something you just mentioned. You said that you can't guarantee that there'll be 100% zero-seat clashes between Muda and Pakatan Harapan in the upcoming state elections. But, you know, you all are minimizing and you will guarantee that there'll be no clashes between Muda and Harapan incumbents. Does that mean that there are a few surprises left? Can we expect any more surprises from Muda as we head towards the nomination? More than six seats, perhaps?
Well, we are going to announce our two other candidates today for Parit Raja and Machap. We have announced the four. And today at 2 p.m., we have circulated the posters that we are going to announce the Parit Raja and Machap. And, you know, at most, I hope that, you know, the people can focus on what we are offering. And the commitment that Muda gives, and it's still a commitment that Muda gives, is that Muda will not contest in seats that are already won by DAP, Amanah and PKR. But if there's anything beyond that, then, you know, we'll just wait and see. But for the time being, it's important for us to also, you know, still focus on the six seats and what are our offerings for from Muda. Within this week, we are going to release our, you know, policy offerings. And I really hope that the people can focus more on what we offer and what our candidates can offer rather than the whole seats fighting between the parties.
Let's move on to pressing matters then. So what are the key issues based on your understanding that Johorians are concerned with right now?
So for the past 2 years, ever since we established Muda, we have actually went on several tour, you know, both physical and virtual, to meet with as many people as possible. And, you know, in order for us to understand what are actual issues on the ground. And from our own data collection, we realized that there are three major issues in Johor. Obviously, there are a lot more underlying issues, but the three major issues in Johor is, number one, the price of goods, price of housing, and quality access to education. And these are the three major issues in Johor that I think we should talk about and all parties should zoom in on. In terms of the price of goods, it's important for you to not just simply trying to control the price of goods and trying to control the ceiling of price of goods, because that's a very short-term solution. Because at the end of the day, when you're talking about price of goods, again, it's a whole ecosystem. Everyone is involved in it. So what government has to do beyond just controlling the ceiling of prices of goods is to create better paying jobs, right? You need to ensure that people have good dignified minimum wage in order for them to have access to these goods that are no longer simply wants, but they are needs of the people. You need to ensure that the government is able to attract investments to develop new industries, because at the end of the day, Johor being very near to Singapore is actually at a very good, it has a very good potential to become the economic hub of Malaysia. And in order for you to make Johor economic hub of Malaysia, is you are able to attract investments and develop new industries that are suitable to the current climate of post-pandemic climate, and ensuring that Johor can compete with its neighbour, which is Singapore. And Johor and Singapore is much closer between Johor and Kuala Lumpur.
That's right.
And so it doesn't make sense if Johor doesn't get to develop as much as its neighbour, right? And so you have to ensure that these things are being taken care of in order for you to solve the issue of not simply solving price of goods, but ensuring that the people are able to have access to these goods, regardless of how the market, the global market changes. Right? Number two is when it comes to housing. And this is something that I have posted very little on my social media, but we are looking very extensively on housing. It's not a matter of simply talking in 1 or 2 minutes when you want to resolve the issue of housing in Johor. The Johor state has the most unsold properties in Malaysia. And that's saying something. That means that at the same time, although a lot of Johorians don't have houses, but we have a lot of unsold properties. Now, these kind of things have to be solved. There's a mismatch between the supply and the demand. And why is that happening? Now, we believe that the luxury property development, while it's needed in order to ensure that there's better investment in the country, it is not the answer for a long-term engine for the average Malaysians, right? You can have luxury property development, but not too much to a point that the average Malaysians can't buy those houses. You need to ensure that there's more and more affordable and low-cost housing, because at the end of the day, the average Malaysians will not be buying this, 600,000 studios, right? They want to buy the houses that are very affordable to their lifestyle and very affordable to the wage that they have as of currently. And so in order for you to ensure that, you have to ensure that there's better assistance and better incentives for the affordable and low-cost housing. And finally, the quality access to education. I think this part should be prioritized, because when we're talking about, comparison between the luxury property development and comparison with ensuring, developing new industries, ensuring that there's quality access to education is actually the easiest thing when you compare to these other matters that you need to tackle, right? And it should be prioritized, because at the end of the day, the new generations are going to shape the future. And if they don't have good quality access to education, how are you going to ensure that the economic justice of the people will grow? Things like ensuring that every child has proper gadget to study, every child has good internet access to continue with online digital learning. Because let's face it, we are in a new era. Whether we like it or not, internet access is a norm now. Online digital learning is a norm. And so internet access has to be available for all child, right? Everyone has to have that. And this is something that the government really has to look into and really prioritize in comparison with other things.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about like how these things are going to be achieved, right? Because when it comes to internet access, you also, I believe in your social media pages, and you have posted videos about how, you know, kids are carrying heavy bags to school and how that needs to end. And one of the methods is to switch to digital learning, right? And Johor is a big state. While the internet is pretty good in urban centers, Johor Bahru and all, you don't really hear much problems about internet. It could be faster and things like that. But it's generally stable. It's generally fine. But everywhere else, not so much. Even in Johor, you have suburban communities that don't get good internet access. You have rural communities that don't get internet access. What are the plans to improve these internet access for the kids? Like, how do you go about that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, when I was talking about the ebook, I also mentioned that recognizing that when you want to introduce ebook, there's a need for you to ensure that there's equal internet access. Now, why do I say that? It's because whether we like it or not, like I mentioned just now, internet is the future. Right? And in so many ways, we have been left behind by our neighboring countries, and we can't afford that anymore. It's time for us to accept that that is the norm now, and we have to focus in order to ensure that we'll be able to compete with our neighboring countries. And in terms of internet access, this has to be the focus of both state and federal government. Now, when we're talking about Pierre and Joe, obviously, we're only going to talk about the context of what ADUN, right, or the, you know, the state legislative assemblymen, assemblywomen can do for their people, right? But in the larger picture of things, the federal government has the responsibility to ensure that the internet reach is, you know, equal to everyone, if not equal at the very least. When I go to, you know, even in the midst of, in the Johor town, there are places where you don't even have 3G. Your line will be like E. And that's really, really problematic, right? We look at cases like, for example, during the online digital learning time, you know, Viviona had to climb a tree in order for her to have an internet access. And there are many more cases where, you know, students got injured and, you know, got sent to hospital because they go to such extreme length in order for them to have access to education. When we look at Malaysia, the broadband subscription in the B40 groups is only at, I think, about 49 to 50%. Meanwhile, in the M40 groups, it's already at 90%. And the T20 is almost 100%. So it shows that the digital divide between the B40 and M40 itself is already very, very huge. And even if they have access to internet, it's very tough because the broadband subscription is not something that is still affordable for them. And so when I was talking about internet access, and I was looking at all the solutions that have been presented by many governments before, I believe that during the Pakatan Harapan time, when YB Gobind introduced the National Connectivity Plan, I think that was a very good plan, right? And it's, you know, I think it's such a sad state that he can't continue with that plan and ensuring that that plan is in place, because obviously it was announced, I think it was in 2019, and the government, you know, was toppled in 2020. But the National Connectivity Plan has to be picked up again in order for you to ensure that everyone has equal access. Within that National Connectivity Plan, there's a plan to also introduce the 25% cut of broadband charges to the people in the B40 community. And I think that's a very good effort as well, especially for the students. It is not wrong for us to now introduce incentive of broadband subscription charges to every student in order for us to ensure that all of them have access to quality education. Now, there are people, when I talked about this, they were saying, oh, but then they will misuse it. You know, they will play Mobile Legends instead of studying. Well, that's out of our control. And that's, you know, a total different matter altogether. You have to provide them that access and that availability first before you're thinking about all these things. Because if you're constantly thinking that they're going to misuse this, you know, this all this, things that we are providing for them, then you'll never provide it for them. And then the digital divide will just grow bigger and bigger. And I think that's very unfair on the B40 community. On top of that, for example, in Puchi Wangsa itself, I know that although it's a very urban area, there are also students who don't have gadgets, who don't have good internet access. Now, among the things that I plan to do if, you know, I'm elected as the representative in Puchi Wangsa, is to ensure that there's good community centers for every student in order for them to ensure that they have access to internet, right? And also in order to ensure that every child or every family has a gadget for them to continue with online digital learning.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. Now, one thing you brought up also, and it is really a problem when you look at Johor, is this idea of, like you said, this luxury condos and a lot of unsold properties. There's just this sort of gap between the supply and demand. And Johor is a state that is undergoing serious, massive overdevelopment, where luxury properties sprouting like mushrooms, mostly taken up by super rich and even Singaporeans. How do you plan to mitigate this problem?
Number one, in terms of the affordable housing and low-cost housing, right? There are already, you know, several very good initiatives in Johor. For example, the rent-to-own homes, the youth transit homes. I was an intern. I was quite some time ago, but I was an intern at Iskandar Regional Development Authority. And so when I looked at these efforts by IRDA, the youth transit homes, the rent-to-own homes, you know, all these schemes are very, very good schemes. But I think what the government has to do is to ensure that there's more investment into these schemes in order for you to ensure, you know, a larger amount of people can have access to all these homes. But on top of that, when we're talking about luxury housing units, I believe that we have to take, you know, the very, I think, very challenging role, but at the same time, very necessary intervention to the sprouting of luxury cost housing homes. Luxury housing properties, right? And so what MUDA is trying to introduce is we want to ensure that we establish a committee. Now, I know that this doesn't sound as sexy as immediately going into it, but it's important for you to have like deeper understanding and deeper research into this matter. Establish a committee to investigate first the feasibility of a vacancy penalty or vacancy tax in other countries for high-end housing properties. And this has been done in many countries, right? Many countries out there. You need to encourage property developers to focus on developing low-cost housing, right? And discourage all this, you know, property hoarding. They develop all these high-end housing properties in sense that only the very rich can afford, and you know, the very rich can buy like, you know, four or five of those luxury cost housing. At the end of the day, the rest of it remains like vacant. And so we have to investigate whether it is feasible for us to tax the developers on the vacancy of this luxury cost housing. And why I mentioned that there's an extensive study that has to be done is because we want to ensure that at the end of the day, when we do this, will it affect investment from outside? Because we also do not want to discourage investors from investing into the property development in Malaysia. But something has to be done. Because I think that right now, the housing development in Johor, like you rightly mentioned, Dashan, is overly skewed towards luxury development and, you know, lesser and lesser on the low-cost housing. And the state government has the responsibility to solve it, whether it's popular or not. Because at the end of the day, it's the regular Malaysians, you know, who are the mass, the majority of Malaysians are the, you know, the M40 people who are now even, they are pushed to the top, the high B40 community. And it is their welfare that we have to take care of. Mm-hmm. Housing is not just a need. Housing is not a right. You have to ensure that everyone has to have access to buy houses. And so although it might be unpopular with the developers, but you need to investigate and really look seriously into vacancy tax.
Certainly. Now, you know, when it comes to, you know, earlier you mentioned price of goods, and even when we talk about, let's say, certain affordable housing and things like that, given the salaries of fresh graduates these days or minimum wage earners, even a concept of an affordable house is sometimes not affordable. You see a lot of people end up renting affordable housing or, you know, and affordable apartments and all of these things because they cannot purchase a house. What do you do when it comes to achieving economic justice? Because there are loads of ways to go about it, right? Raising wages, taxation and all of these things to achieve economic justice. What is MUDA's focus when it comes to achieving economic justice? How do you plan to go about it?
Rightfully, as you pointed out, the minimum wage in Malaysia is still not much of a dignified wage. The minimum wage right now is at 1,100 ringgit in majority of places, and in KL is 1,200 ringgit. Meanwhile, a report by EPF mentioned that in order for a single person to live dignifiedly, and live dignifiedly is like cukup-cukup makan like that. You know, in order for them to live dignifiedly in Malaysia, they need a minimum wage of 2,500 ringgit. So what does it tell you? It tells you that the country is aware that this is the cost of living right now. But at the end of the day, we are still stuck at the minimum wage of, you know, 20 or 30 years back. And this is something that you need to change. So for Muda, we believe that, you know, obviously this is something that, again, you can't introduce immediately from 1,200 ringgit to 2,500 ringgit, right? But what we can do is we can introduce a special scheme to introduce targeted wage incentive, right? This special scheme should be introduced largely to affected groups during COVID-19. For example, the fresh graduates, for example, those who were entrenched, those who lost jobs because, you know, of the closing of border between Singapore and Johor. So you introduce this targeted wage incentive to ensure that all these people get to live dignifiedly, even with the issues of pandemic COVID-19, you know, affecting them. At the same time, again, when we're talking about economic justice, like I mentioned just now, it's also very important for us to ensure that there's access to quality education. What does this mean? So when I was in Padu, what we realized is that there's a huge mismatch between what's provided in the education in Malaysia and what's out there in the working field. Again, this is something a little bit outside of the state government's jurisdiction, but then it is something that the federal government has to look into it seriously. So the mismatch between what we are providing in education and what's out there in work field is very, very dangerous, because we're always talking about, you know, we have to have more STEM graduates, we have to have more STEM graduates. But while I was in Padu, we realized that a lot of STEM graduates do not have jobs when they, you know, graduate. Or even if they have jobs that are not something that they studied. Meanwhile, with, you know, IR 4.0, actually what is really important for us to provide to students are TVET education. Before this, we always looked at TVET as a subpar to you know, to science, to, you know, law, engineering. We always look at those who are in TVET as the second, you know, second tier. But that's not it. The future of the world is actually TVET, right? You need to look into this, all these things about, you know, the vocational education, ensuring that there's more efforts and incentives given to students who wanted to join TVET education, right? And at the same time, I think all these things can ensure that after they graduate, they have a dignified job that can pay them well, and will, again, help them out in the long run with the social economic justice of, you know, their lifestyle as well.
All right, Amira, before we wrap this conversation up, would you have a final message to Johorians, especially, you know, if there are people in who might be voting in Puteri Wangsa and they might be listening in, what message would you have for them?
Muda always believes that it's high time for us to have new political culture in the country. It's high time for us to have leaders who believe in the politics of service, leaders who believe in politics of policy, and leaders who believe in politics of value, where money and power is not important, but what's important is what the people want. And Muda is going to fight for that in Johor. Now, if you believe in what Muda is fighting for, I implore all Johorians to come out to vote, right? In Puteri Wangsa, if you believe in what I'm fighting for, come out and vote. But as a whole, regardless whichever party you believe in, voting is your right and voting is your democratic responsibility, right? We don't want to have a case where the state leadership is only elected by half of the population, like in Melaka, only 58% or 55%. And that doesn't reflect the state, you know, the state's views as a whole. The power is in your hand. What I want to say is just to come out to vote for whoever you believe in, to vote who you think can speak for you, who you think fight for your right. And together, we can ensure that there's political stability in Johor. And together, we can ensure that Johor can become a thriving state and a thriving economy in Malaysia.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Amira.
Thank you so much, Dashrin.
That was Amira Aisha. She's the SecGen of Parti Muda, talking to me ahead of the upcoming Johor State elections. So if you missed any part of this conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.